False information about the coronavirus is everywhere. So who's spreading it?
The vast majority, 38%, of the COVID misinformation was in association with the name of the President of the United States.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the daughter of a Holocaust survivor faces anti-Semitic harassment in 2020 America.
The experience gave me a newfound understanding of what my family might have felt like as targets of hate.
And a Danish energy company was hooked on fossil fuels. Now it's a green powerhouse.
Denmark is the size of Maryland, and yet they compete with China for the number one manufacturing of wind turbines.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you can make it here today. Falsehoods and conspiracy theories involving COVID-19 are ricocheting around the globe, in many cases spreading faster than the disease itself.
I execute judgment on you, COVID-19!
Is the Wuhan coronavirus a biological weapon?
Well, when the Communist Party threatens to attack America by withholding critical medical supplies, that is a biological weapon.
We don't really know how the data is being collected.
Amazing.
This is the cure right here going into mass production, and this is going to save and change the world.
So you hold a blow dryer in front of your face, and you inhale with your nose, and it kills all the viruses in your nose.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that?
To be clear, that is all misinformation. It might make for a laugh, but a potentially deadly disease is anything but funny. A new study from Cornell University finds that the main drivers of all this misinformation are just a small handful of sources. And at the top of the list, President Donald Trump. Sarah Evangia is the study's lead author.
We looked at 38 million articles in the English language traditional media, and within that pool, about 1.1 million articles contain some kind of misinformation. And when we drill down further, we see that there are about 11 subtopics that really dominate the misinformation landscape. And within those 11 subtopics, there is one that is by far the biggest subtopic: miracle cures. And when we drill in further and look at those miracle cure topics, which included hydroxychloroquine, UV, disinfectant, what we see is that's often associated with particular people of global prominence, in particular, the President of the United States.
So what role is President Trump's social media feed playing, not just in the U.S., but globally? Like, how do people outside the U.S. pick up on Trump's misinformation?
Yeah, well, you could also ask the question, what role is the media really playing in amplifying the voices of a small number of people who happen to have a big platform? We found that 16% of the coverage was actually fact-checking, which is great. And so I think as we approach a potential second wave of an infodemic, just as we've, you know, approached a second wave of the pandemic, and as vaccines begin to become available, I think there's a really important role for the media to play in flattening that second infodemic curve.
Infodemic, that's a new word.
It is, and it was coined by the World Health Organization. And of course, with social media and access to so much information that we have today, it really has become a serious concern in fighting the pandemic.
Right. Another finding of your study, Sarah, was conspiracy theories, the idea that sinister groups are behind the pandemic. That accounted for almost half the misinformation cited. What kind of conspiracy theories dominated?
There were a range of different conspiracy theories that come up, ranging from 5G to bat soup, a range of different things that sort of came and went over the period between January and May.
Did you dive into the psychology of how misinformation spreads? Like, why do people like President Trump peddle falsehoods? Is it ignorance or something more nefarious?
I think it ranges to a great extent. I mean, there are certainly some groups that spread misinformation or disinformation for political gain or financial gain. But I think what we saw was that many of the topics, the misinformation topics, came and went and may have been amplified by fringe groups or not. But what was interesting was that the majority of the amplification really came from a very small number of prominent people with large platforms.
What is being done to try to stop the spread of misinformation, of false news? I mean, can it be stopped?
Yeah, I think that the media has a huge role to play. I'd love to see that percentage of fact-checking that we saw in the study be a greater portion of the misinformation coverage around COVID-19. I think the media has a tremendous role to play in preventing future infodemics and really being aware of the risk of false balance in reporting. And of course, using bona fide experts as sources is really key.
Sarah Evangia directs Cornell University's Alliance for Science. She's the lead author of a new study on the vast reach of coronavirus misinformation. Sarah, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
When President Trump told the so-called Proud Boys to stand back and stand by during Tuesday night's debate, it was deeply troublesome for a lot of people, and for obvious reasons. The Anti-Defamation League describes this particular group as a, quote, dangerous strain of far-right extremists, including members who are violent and some who espouse white supremacist views. In the right environment, hateful ideologies can just fester. Here's a concrete example of what I mean. It happened to someone you heard about on the show a few years ago. Daphne Geismar had recently published a book about her Dutch Jewish grandparents' lives during World War II. They were given a hiding shelter from the Nazis in a church in Rotterdam. Daphne's mother, Miriam Geismar, then a girl, was also in hiding. In 2015, I met both of them to hear their story of survival during the war. The church is still there today with a plaque out front explaining its role hiding Jews during the war. Where physically in the church were they?
In the roof.
In the roof of the church?
Yes, yeah. You tell them.
Miriam Geismar is talking to her daughter, Daphne, there. Yeah. Daphne has become kind of the keeper of her parents' and grandparents' history. She knows their story well.
The minister went to the caretaker of the church and said, I would like you to help me create a place for this Jewish couple to hide. The caretaker said, well, I never told you this, but there's another Jewish family that's been hiding in the attic for a year already. So they made a second hiding place, so they were mirror images on either side of the organ pipes.
That was in 2015. Since then, Miriam Geismar has died, and Daphne wrote a book called Invisible Years about the whole ordeal. Last month, Daphne was giving an online presentation of her book to a group of Holocaust survivors and their families in Connecticut when the presentation was hacked. Daphne Geismar joins me from New Haven, Connecticut. What happened during this presentation back in August, Daphne?
The presentation started with a page from my grandfather's diary where he documented a Nazi raid on the church where he was hiding, which was explained in that clip you just played. And so when I started the presentation and I had this image of the diary as the first slide, if you will. At first, I thought there was something wrong with my slides because I started seeing little blue letters on them, and that turned into anti-Semitic graffiti. My first reaction was that I was horrified and enraged and thought that perhaps we should stop, but the moderator encouraged me to continue. It was really important to the folks at Voices of Hope that we not let them stop us. And so I continued with the presentation. I was in a bit of shock and somehow able to separate myself from what was happening. It was kind of like I was on autopilot. Because there were so many people on this Zoom presentation, it took them over 15 minutes to block the person or persons who were creating this hateful graffiti on top of the presentation.
Also, there was an audio hack, right? What were you hearing?
Yes. While swastikas and kill Jews and worse were being written, somebody shouted out, the Holocaust never happened.
Why did you feel, Daphne, it was important to continue the presentation even while all this was going on?
It's so important not to be silent or silenced. So what the attackers were doing were they were trying to intimidate and shut us down and silence. And we were all in agreement that we weren't going to let that happen.
And you kept going. To be clear, you do not know who did this, a group, an individual, or what, right?
No, we don't know. Voices of Hope notified the police of the hate crime and the news media and the Anti-Defamation League, and the police have been looking into it. And the one person who they have identified is in Canada. So the fact that it's in another country makes it more complicated. So it's ongoing.
I got to say, I mean, we've met before. You sound emotionally spent. What's it been like the last few weeks?
The experience gave me a newfound understanding of what my family might have felt like as targets of hate by people who knew nothing about them.
Daphne, how do you carry on with your own story that is, you know, informing the public that the Holocaust did happen and we need to be vigilant that it doesn't happen again when you are seeing signs of the opposite?
I think it's really important to continue telling the story. And my parents and many other survivors, well, for the first 50 years, they didn't say anything because that's what they had to do to be able to move on. But then in the 80s and 90s, they started telling their stories and going to community centers and school groups. And now, for the most part, they're not here anymore to keep telling their stories. So I feel really fortunate and responsible to be the holder of this archive, to create this book.
Do you see more presentations coming up for Invisible Years?
Yes, there are already some scheduled for the fall, and it's important to continue to do them.
Daphne Geismar, the book about her mother and grandparents' story of survival during World War II in the Netherlands is called Invisible Years. Daphne, thank you very much for telling us the story.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you think of debates, the word civil probably does not come to mind right now.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
The question is, the Supreme Court Justice, radical left. Will you shut
up,
man?
Listen, who is on your list?
That was, of course, President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden mixing it up on Tuesday night. If you need a debate palate cleanser, and who amongst us doesn't, may I suggest checking out what happened in New Zealand last night.
Tēnā tātou katoa. There are 17 days to go. Welcome to the News Hub Decision 2020 Leaders Debate in a COVID-19.
A debate heavy on issues and light on personal attacks. The moderator, Patrick Gower, asked questions about New Zealand's housing problems, national debt, and its response to the coronavirus. The two candidates, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and challenger Judith Collins, provided detailed answers and plans.
We established criteria that says there should not be community transmission in Australia when we open our borders.
The two candidates listened and agreed on some points, even complimented each other.
You have called Jacinda Ardern a celebrity prime minister.
Yes, yeah.
So,
what does that mean? Well, it actually means, Ms. Ardern, is that overseas, you know, people know who you are, and I think that's lovely. I think it's good.
Now, it was a debate, so it did get heated at times with some subtle digs.
The world is changing. Unfortunately, Judith Collins does not want to change with it. Unless we move quickly, we lose an opportunity.
Look, if Jacinda Ardern is going to use my age against me, I'm happy to use my experience.
Collins is 61.
Prime Minister Ardern is 40. The two candidates also clashed on issues like education and whether to legalize cannabis. But there were no sharp personal attacks, no accusations of lying, just disagreements. In other words, debate. New Zealand with a healthy reminder of the way it's supposed to work. Coming up next on today's program, how Denmark came to control the wind game, and later, students in Thailand behaving badly, and I mean seriously misbehaving, but not the way you might be thinking. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Denmark announced this week that it's on track to meet its ambitious climate change goals. By 2030, it's aiming to cut carbon emissions 70% from 1990 levels. It won't be cheap. Climate Minister Dan Jorgensen says it'll cost billions of dollars. But he says it'll also create jobs in the renewable energy sector. Denmark is a big player in wind energy. In the last decade, a major Danish utility has transitioned away from fossil fuels and become the world's biggest offshore wind developer. How did they make the change? That's now on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn
turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's Anna Kussmer reports on the reinvention of the Danish energy company Ørsted.
Ørsted produces the electricity that powers a fifth of Danish homes. And in the 2010s, they completely changed their business model.
We no longer produce oil and gas and have decided to stop all use of coal to focus entirely on green energy.
In a decade, they went from producing 85% of their electricity from oil, gas, and coal to producing that same percentage from renewables. They had been called Dong, but in 2017, they released a promotional video reinventing themselves.
Because of our transformation, Dong, originally short for Danish oil and natural gas, no longer reflects who we are. So we're even changing our name to Ørsted.
Ørsted. An 18th century Danish energy scientist lending his name to what is now a massive wind energy company.
What they've achieved is off the scale. They're the biggest wind producer in the world.
Dave Jones is an electricity analyst with Ember, a clean energy think tank. He says Ørsted is, in fact, one of the only energy utilities in the world that has been able to simultaneously grow its renewables and shrink oil and gas production.
It takes an awful lot of vision to have such an aggressive strategy like that. So what they've done is amazing. It hasn't been repeated many times.
So how did they do it? Partly, it comes down to government energy policy. Finn Mortensen leads State of Green, an organization that promotes Danish renewable energy.
My argument would be that we had some far-sighted governments and civil servants at the time who could see that there was a possibility to start focusing on wind.
Mortensen says the global oil shortage in the 70s led to decades of government incentives for wind to grow in Denmark. Subsidies, state-backed research and development, carbon and pollution taxes, support for rural energy cooperatives. Ørsted is benefiting from all of that.
The government backing was simply key to the success.
The government prioritized wind, and it worked.
They had a faster transition to wind energy than any other country on Earth.
Benjamin Sovacool is a Danish energy policy expert at the University of Sussex in the UK.
Denmark is the size of Maryland, and yet they compete with China for the number one manufacturing of wind turbines.
Two of the world's biggest wind energy manufacturers are in Denmark. You know that classic wind turbine design, the three spinning blades? You can thank Danish engineers for that. So it makes sense that the country's biggest energy utility would eventually capitalize on one of the country's biggest innovations. Ørsted's exceptional leap towards wind was actually kind of a no-brainer. Here's Sovacool again.
They didn't get in the way, but they certainly didn't accelerate it much either. They kind of just went along with general trends that were being pushed politically and socially.
Sovacool says Ørsted also has the benefit of the stable and reliable Danish energy market, and it's helped the company's bottom line. Years of state-supported innovation have led to a massive decrease in the cost of wind in Denmark, and the company has expanded internationally. They now produce around a third of the world's offshore wind, mostly in Europe, but also on the east coast of the U.S., in Taiwan, Japan, and Korea. Here's Finn Mortensen again, from the Danish Renewable Energy Organization.
If you look at the capital value of the company, it has gone up dramatically since 2016, when they really got underway with wind development.
The company reported more than $10 billion in revenue last year.
It has turned into a virtual cash cow for the Danish government. They still own 50% of the stock.
In the first 5 years of its transition, Ørsted accounted for more than half of Denmark's carbon emission reductions. Glenda Napier heads a new energy innovation organization called Energy Cluster Denmark. She says Ørsted's decision to scrap oil and gas in favor of renewables created a ripple effect.
I think it just pushed the whole sort of green agenda a lot more than if they would have kept both activities up until now.
The company's success helps to solidify Denmark's role as a leader in wind globally.
I mean, they can attract the best people. They can attract the best sub-suppliers. They are very competitive in the market. They've moved in the right direction at the right point of time.
Attracting the best minds can help Denmark push the technology even further, Napier says, in Denmark and around the world, to develop new ways of storing wind energy and use it to power cars, trucks, even airplanes. For the world, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Ørsted today announced they inked a deal for a new ship to help build and maintain offshore wind projects off the east coast of the U.S. They've got several wind farms here in the works, but have faced regulatory delays in getting them built. Today's deal marks a step forward. Do you have a question about how to solve the problems that come with a changing climate? Email your question to climate@theworld.org. In Colombia, a musician is raising awareness about the environment by mixing the sounds of nature with electronica. Simon Mejia has found some answers to some of the most pressing environmental issues right in his backyard outside Bogota.
Since I got here, I became more aware in the mornings at what exact time the sounds begin, no? So I don't have, when I live in the city, I have my alarm clock, no, with the phone and everything. Now my alarm clock are those sounds. You become more aware. And now during quarantine, many people that still live in Bogota in the cities were telling me, like, wow, I'm listening to some birds like at 5 or 5:30 a.m. that I never listened before.
Mejia's new music project is not just a sonic experiment. He's raising awareness about nature, wilderness, and the people who rely on it. Tune in tomorrow for more music and conversation with Simon Mejia here on The World. With the world. Buyer beware, the clothes you purchase could have been manufactured in a modern day concentration camp.
Concentration camps should infuriate you, should mobilize you, should prevent you from sleeping at night.
A lawmaker in France wants you to stop buying those clothes. That's in the next half hour here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A group of American human rights lawyers say they can't do their work because of President Trump. And now they're suing the Trump administration, saying an executive order has gagged them and is preventing them from pursuing justice. The order signed in June by President Trump threatens serious consequences for anyone supporting the work of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in The Hague. Diane Marie Amen is a professor of international law at the University of Georgia and one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Diane, you state in your claims that this executive order from Trump has halted the work of you and your colleagues. Can you explain how exactly?
We four plaintiffs, Milena Stereo, Meg de Guzman, Gabor Rona, and I, are all academics who have worked in various ways pro bono to assist the work of the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Speaking personally, I've had the deep honor to serve since 2012 as Prosecutor Bensouda's special advisor on children in and affected by armed conflict. What I do is try to do my own small part to help children who are tortured, killed, sexually abused, and otherwise harmed in war zones throughout the world. In order to do that, I give advice to the prosecutor. I speak with members of her staff. I help to prepare a policy on children. I engage student researchers to assist me in my work, and I speak publicly. Because of the president's order, I am gagged from doing any of those things. out of fear that they would be seen as giving assistance to the prosecutor who has now been designated by the president for sanctions.
So the executive order from Trump was followed last month by the imposition of sanctions. You touched on a little of that there. Essentially, you're in a dilemma because the main target of those sanctions is the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, the woman you just mentioned. You've worked as an unpaid special advisor to Bensouda on children in conflict zones for the past 8 years. So what is the status today of your relationship with Bensouda?
From the moment of her designation on September 2nd, I have been forced to stop all communication with her. I cannot give advice. I am even unable to speak publicly in support of the work of the prosecutor because there is a risk under the legal framework that the administration has set up that even speaking favorably about work the court is doing could bring me within the umbrella of sanctions myself.
Diane, if you were to be sanctioned, how would that affect you personally and professionally?
I'm a first-generation college graduate with no independent wealth. I have a house. I have a retirement account. I have a family that depends on those assets. If I were sanctioned and my property were seized, I would be destitute. Mm.
Now, the actions taken by the Trump administration came in response to an investigation by the ICC into alleged war crimes committed by the U.S. and its allies in Afghanistan. Have you been worried that Trump is trying to protect Americans from prosecution at the ICC?
Certainly, the public statements of Secretary Pompeo, Attorney General Barr, and others state that there is that fear. It's important to make clear that the International Criminal Court is a court of last resort. What that means is if a country whose citizens are suspected of committing crimes, if that country thoroughly investigates those allegations and punishes people who are responsible for them, the ICC has no jurisdiction whatsoever. The problem with Afghanistan is that the United States has not done that. And the fact that it has not engaged in serious investigations of conduct in Afghanistan has exposed itself to be subject to inquiry by the International Criminal Court.
Diane Marie Amon is a professor of international law at the University of Georgia and one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Trump administration. Thank you very much for being with us, Diane.
Thank you.
New evidence shows that China is expanding its persecution of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority. A recent report from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute discovered 380 camps, nearly double the number previously thought. China calls the camps in northwest Xinjiang region re-education facilities. Human rights groups say they're concentration camps and that people held in them are subjected to forced labor, even torture. That has not stopped some of the world's top retailers from including Uyghur labor in their supply chains. In Europe, one unconventional politician is leading a campaign to end that. In Paris, Rebecca Rossman has our report.
Raphael Glucksmann is not your typical politician. In fact, the French activist and journalist will be the first one to tell you he kind of hates politicians.
Basically, when they speak, they only have talking points and they don't believe in what they say.
When he won a seat in European Parliament last year, Glucksmann promised his office would be something different.
And basically to try to be the voice of the voiceless people.
When he says he wants to be the voice of the voiceless people, he doesn't just mean in France. Right now, one of the populations he's most concerned about are the Uyghur Muslims in China.
You have 3 million people in concentration camps. Just this word, concentration camps, should infuriate you, should mobilize you, should prevent you from sleeping at night.
Glucksmann first learned about the atrocities taking place in Xinjiang last fall, when he invited a group of Uyghur exiles to his office. He also read a report by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which named 83 international retailers profiting from Uyghur forced labor. And that's when he saw an opportunity.
Il y a quelques semaines, je suis allé à la rencontre d'une des rares rescapées de ces camps.
He launched a campaign on social media where he called out the offending brands and tried to mobilize a generation of youth to help spread the word.
I stopped buying everything that on the list that was posted on social media.
Emma Madani is an 18-year-old student who says she learned about the conditions in the Uyghur camps through Glucksmann's Instagram.
Zara, H&M, Samsung, Google, Amazon, Jack and Jones, there's so many.
Today she wears a face mask that says Free Uyghurs. Madani is one of hundreds of young people who recently gathered in a small corner of eastern Paris for a day of activism. They turned this square into a sort of utopia. People handed out food and flyers while others discussed different human rights causes, including the plight of the Uyghurs.
I am more hopeful now than before.
Dilnur Rehan is president of the European Uyghur Institute and has worked with Glucksmann on his campaign. She says the youth involvement over the past year has helped them make real change.
Before, I felt powerless because the genocide is here and no politicians or government respond. But now the situation is changed because now I know, as a simple citizen, each of us have power.
Glucksmann has been able to harness that power and convince some brands, including H&M and Lacoste, to cut their ties with Xinjiang. But he says other brands will only change if they're forced by law. That's why he's working on a legislative proposal that would require any retailers that want to sell in Europe to remove forced labor from their supply chains. Otherwise, they could be fined or go to jail.
And that's basic. If you do that in France, you go to jail directly. So why on earth would you think that you can escape from any form of penal responsibility if you do that in China?
Last month, the Trump administration passed a law restricting imports on certain products from Xinjiang, citing forced labor. Glucksmann quickly applauded Trump for the ban.
He represents everything I reject. But I don't care. For me, human rights are more important than my vision of the world. So if he does something right, I will say it. Of course. I think now European leaders should die out of shame. They allowed Donald Trump to be a leader on confronting the most massive human rights violation in today's world.
That's why Glucksmann says for now he's focused on mobilizing everyday citizens. The next time someone wears a Zara shirt or Nike shoes, he wants them to think about where the product came from. And if they're disturbed with what they discover, he hopes they'll heed his call to action. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
Fighting is continuing for the fifth straight day in a part of the world that straddles Europe and Central Asia. Heavy shelling between forces from Armenia and Azerbaijan. Dozens of casualties have been reported since Sunday. The two sides are basically fighting over land, a disputed region in the Caucasus called Nagorno-Karabakh. The major powers in the area, Turkey and Russia, are also getting involved. To help make sense of all this, we're joined now by Simon Sarajian. He's the director of the Russia Matters Project at the Harvard Kennedy School. You were born, I understand, in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, Simon. I think there are a lot of people, including myself, that don't know much about the area. So can you start by describing it for us?
I was born in the village of Haiparis, which used to be part of the Gulistan Principality of Karabakh, but was carved out and given to Azeri Soviet Republic when the Soviet Union was established. It's a beautiful area. Some call it the Switzerland of Caucasus, rolling hills, mountains, alpine meadows, fast streams, breathtaking. My heart is always there.
So since Sunday, Simon, we've seen an outburst of violence in Nagorno-Karabakh. What are the two sides fighting over and why this most recent outburst?
They're fighting over what they view as the most precious thing in the world, the land. I'd say it's the worst fighting since the ceasefire, and it has the greatest potential to become a regional war because of involvement of Turkey, not just diplomatic or material support, but according to the Armenian side, and according to international agencies that quote rebels from Syria who go and fight now against Armenia. So at this time, I only see a path towards further hostilities until external powers with leverage, real leverage, intervene and convince both sides that it's time to lay down arms and negotiate.
What are the alliances that you're seeing at play with the Nagorno-Karabakh violence, and what's at stake for all of them?
the strongest material presence on the ground that is actually involved in combat is the Turkish Azeri alliance. Two nations that describe themselves as one nation, two states. For the first time, we see a foreign power send fighters to the neighborhood, which Russia has explicitly called a zone of its privileged interests. Okay? So that's unprecedented.
That sounds, that Turkish-Azeri alliance, it sounds really strong. Is it essentially unassailable? And what is Turkey's intent in getting involved in this conflict?
Turkey's intent is to attain defeat of the Armenian forces so that Azeri would expand control of land and through that expand its influence in the South Caucasus, a region for influence in which it used to compete fiercely with Russia and Iran.
Is there a formula, Simon, do you think, that could lead to another ceasefire? What are you hearing from Western countries?
I'm not privy to discussions among Western diplomats or any diplomats. From what I see, the today's statement by members of the Minsk group is a welcome sign. If they back that statement, calls for peace, with signaling that those who refuse to heed the call would be facing real consequences in terms of sanctions, I think that could help to discontinue the fighting. Vis-a-vis the two players, Russia has by far the strongest leverage. So Russia single-handedly could bring the two countries to discontinue hostilities as it has done before. Okay, but ceasefire is achievable, I think.
Who makes up the Minsk group?
Russia, France, U.S.
You said you are not privy to any diplomatic conversations, but do you see energy behind the Minsk group that could lead to a ceasefire?
Minsk group has done its share of work trying to bring the two countries together. But the thing is, the positions have become irreconcilable. On the Armenian side, there's no way Armenia would agree to Karabakh returning to Azerbaijan, returning, quote, unquote, returning. On the Azeri side, there's no way they can see any solution in which Karabakh is not made part of Azerbaijan. So until their positions on that change, there's not going to be peace, no matter what the Minsk group is, what other formats are used. It's just not going to work.
As you told us earlier, Simon, you were born in Nagorno-Karabakh. So for you personally, how has this conflict weighed on you and your family and the prospect that it's going to be hard to end it?
Well, it's weighing heavily. I mean, I feel for people there. I lost my village to a combined operation of then Soviet interior troops and Azeri police. Okay, so my village is no more. But all the peaceful people living in Karabakh, I feel for them, and I hope this hostilities end and neither civilians on neither side suffer anymore. But that's just my hope. The reality is unfortunately different.
Simon Sarajan is the director of the Russia Matters Project at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Simon, thank you for taking the time today to explain this to us.
Thank you.
Marie Antoinette once said of her hungry subjects, "Let them eat cake." Well, if the Queen had been reading the news out of Ireland's Supreme Court this week, she may have said, "Let them eat Subway bread." That's right, the rolls for your $5 footlong. The High Court has ruled that Subway's bread is too sugary to qualify as bread under the country's tax rules. Katie McGinnis is a food writer and restaurant critic based in Dublin. She's been following this. How much is this news rocking the food world, Katie, or at least the bread world?
Most of us are kind of having a bit of a giggle about it, to be honest. So the case has come out of a dispute between an operator of some Subway franchises here about a tax bill dating back a number of years. That ended up in the Supreme Court, who gave their judgment this week. And because of the sugar content in the Subway bread, it does not qualify as a staple food because apparently it contains 10% sugar, which I think is phenomenal, actually. So it ruled that Subway's bread is not bread, it's cake.
So let's back up a second. I'm still kind of confused how tax rules are involved in this whole thing ended up in the court in the first place.
It's a dispute in relation to the amount of tax that should be charged on the sandwiches. Staple foods attract a value-added tax of 0%, and sort of more exotic foods and discretionary foods would attract a higher tax rate. The idea being that if you're making a sandwich with regular bread, there's no VAT tax that applies to that bread. Whereas if you were selling a cake, you would be adding a 13.5% tax to it.
Okay, so Subway bread may have lots of sugar. Don't most breads have sugar?
Well, the rule here is that to qualify as a bread, you have less than 2% sugar. And in fact, I went off to my local supermarket yesterday and picked up a load of different breads to see what the sugar content of each loaf was. And they ranged between, I think, 0.6 grams per slice and I think 1.7 grams per slice or per 100 grams. So it's less than 2% generally across the board. And of course, if you make your own bread, as so many of us have been doing during the pandemic, particularly sourdough, you'll know that there's no sugar in it at all, other than the naturally occurring sugar that comes from, you know, the fermentation process.
And just remind us where the Subway bread rolls stand on the sugar scale. Like, how high up are they?
10%, apparently.
So that's really high end.
It's very high. I've actually never tasted one. I don't know whether I should be ashamed to admit that or not, but maybe I should go out and try one and see how sweet it is.
Katie McGinnis is a food writer and restaurant critic based in Dublin. Good luck finding a Subway sandwich one of these days.
Thank you very much. It was very nice to talk to you.
Thailand, through the eyes of the average tourist, is often seen as a freewheeling, anything-goes sort of place. The reality is a little different. For example, every student in Thailand grows up learning there are some things you just can't say and some people you don't question. Class and hierarchy are taught in school. Conservatives say this creates an orderly society. But as the world's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok, there's a new movement of self-proclaimed bad students who are shocking the country by taking on its biggest taboo.
This is how the school day always starts in Thailand, with the national anthem. At 8 in the morning, students gather under the flag and sing along, vowing to shed every drop of blood for their country. Nothing strange about this. American kids say the Pledge of Allegiance, and most countries try to ingrain kids with a sense of patriotism. But in Thailand, there are other rituals of obedience. Like, on special occasions, prostrating yourself before your teacher, dropping to your hands and knees, your head touching the floor. There's even a special song for this. It's just generally not okay to question your teacher's authority. Most kids go along with it, but some think this culture of submissiveness keeps Thai society stuck in the past. Like this student, Panacea Sitijitawatanakun. She says, it is so clear. We're taught that humans are not equal. Panacea goes by Rung, which means rainbow. And I found Rung in her college dorm. She's 22 and newly famous, infamous, some would say, for challenging Thailand's status quo. These days, she says, there are often police posted outside of her dorm, watching her, following her around. Yeah, Rung is in big trouble. Back to that in a minute. First, to understand the root of her trouble, you gotta go back to high school, when she was just a normal middle-class teenager, from a family who sells auto parts. And when she went to school, all the bowing and scraping, the obsession with hierarchy, it just bugged her. She says she felt they were teaching her that there's always someone higher than you. And if you somehow get to their level, you'll have people bowing at your feet too. There was the time her teacher made everyone go home and wash their mom's feet and take a photo of it as proof to show to the class. Rung says she thought it was silly. There was another lesson that wasn't her favorite, learning Ratchasap, which is a special language, a very ornate form of Thai, that you must know just in case you meet a member of Thailand's royal family. Meeting royalty, you can't just say the words me or I. You have to say, Thai Pha Laong Thuli Prabhat, beneath the dust at the soles of your holy feet. So, I'm pleased to meet you is more like, beneath the dust at the soles of your holy feet is pleased to meet you. Rung says, I don't know, I just figured that if I never met royalty, I'd never use it. Now, in Thailand's hierarchy, no one is higher than the royal family. Thai children learn early on that the family is sacrosanct. Politicians may run the country day to day, but the king is the head of state, embodying the greatness of Thailand. And each night on TV, after the news, there's the royal news, where anchors have to use that special language.
พระบาทสมเด็จพระเจ้าอยู่หัวและสมเด็จพระนางเจ้าพระบรมราชินีนาถเสด็จออกณพระที่นั่งอัมพรสถาน
In this broadcast, Thailand's king is blessing Thai officials, who dress in all-white suits and crawl on the carpet before him. The king is 68. He took over 4 years ago, after the death of his father, who had ruled for 70 years. The current king spends much of his time in Europe, flying back to Thailand for ceremonies. Now, criticizing royalty is blasphemy. It can put you in prison. And that brings us back to Rung's modern-day troubles. Seven weeks ago, she got on stage at a political rally on her campus, and she said this. Today, she said, we're going to discuss the royal institution openly. Then she read a manifesto that questioned the role of the palace in society, its wealth, how it is intertwined with the powerful military, and of course, the laws against critiquing the palace. Before getting on stage, Rung says she was super tense, having no idea if people would accept her ideas. Her vision for the monarchy is closer to what you see in Japan, or the UK, where people can say pretty much anything about Queen Elizabeth or Prince Harry. That might not sound radical, but in Thailand, it's radical, because people learn from childhood that the monarchy is the nation's soul. And many Thai people have contempt for people like Rung. They think she's a traitor, and she is now facing sedition charges for speaking about the palace. Frankly, it's a little surprising that she is not stuck in a cell right now. Yeah, she says, I'm just waiting. When are they going to do something to me? In the meantime, Rung, who was unknown 8 weeks ago, is building a small fan base, especially among young Thais, sarcastically calling themselves bad students, bad as in disobedient. A few thousand protesters gathered outside Thailand's parliament recently, like this 19-year-old who goes by the name Chil. When I ask for her thoughts on Rung, she starts shaking with emotion. She's so gifted, Chil says. So amazing. Chil and the others here are protesting what they call the feudal order. The crowd is mixed, young and old, but they're about to run through a ritual everyone knows from their days in school, singing the national anthem. There's a disobedient twist, though. When they sing, everyone holds up three fingers, a symbol borrowed from the Hunger Games, in which young rebels fight tyranny. Rung is here, of course, getting mobbed by students who want selfies. It's crazy loud, but Rung tells me she's pleased so many protesters have come out and that they're ready for whatever comes. But one of Rung's friends tells me she's actually a bit stressed right now because of the police posted nearby. No, because it's Thursday and Rung has a big class presentation tomorrow morning. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
That's where we say goodbye today. We're always online at theworld.org. On Twitter, we're at theworld. I'm there too, at Marco Werman. Stay strong, be healthy. We're back with you tomorrow.